Hi, everyone. Welcome to the timingresearch.com crowd forecast news, episode number 246 for November 18th, 2019. We are recording this at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. My name is David Kosmeter. I'm the creator of timingresearch.com. And today we will be discussing the 321st weekly report. So if you haven't had a chance to take a look at this yet, just go to timingresearch.com/reports and you can get access to the web or PDF version there. Just a reminder, too, you can also listen to the audio-only podcast version of all episodes from Timing Research. Just search on your favorite podcast app or network or Timing Research, and you can subscribe there. You can look up Timing Research on YouTube and subscribe there for instant updates on new episodes. So today I've arranged for Neil Batho, Norman Hallett, and Jim Kenny to join us, and Jim will be moderating, and I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Jim.
Great. Thank you, David, and thanks everybody for being here. We are continuing up the ladder here on the S&P, hit 3121 earlier today. And so we're going to hear from these guys and see what they think is going to be happening this week and get a lot of information on what they're watching as well. So without further ado, let's get introduced to everybody. The first guy up here is going to be Neil Batho of TraderReview.net. And Neil, for those who haven't met you yet, why don't you give a little background on yourself and what's cooking at Trader Review?
What's cooking? What does The Rock say? Can you smell what The Rock's been cooking? I'll have to have a sound effect for next time, Jim. That's your department.
Okay.
Right out of college, I was a broker for a year, and then I like making the stock picks, and then I realized I got to call every single client and convince them why they should buy. You know what I said, and my first ever client I inherited, and it was a $30,000 account, 99 late or 2000 early, or 98 or 99 early in the year, 99 early in the year. And I call him up, I say, I'm going to put half your money in Sun Microsystems, half the money in Intel. And he told me that he had to call his neighbor and da-di-da-di-da. Eventually, I put it in. Check back a year later, Sun Microsystems doubled. Intel was up 30%. And I often wondered what happened to that guy. But it's really a sales job. So I did some consulting, and then I started, you know, what I do now, which is just making the stock picks, which is what I really love.
Okay, sounds great. And Norm, obviously a lot of people already know you, but for those uninitiated, let us know background on yourself and thedisciplinetrader.com.
Thanks, Jim. For those crazy enough not to know me, my background really, I ran a very large option firm back in the 1980s. I also have managed.
Norm is on the next Ocean's 11 movie, by the way. Norm will be in.
I've also managed money as a CTA. I've had my own IB. I've been trading for a long time. But I can't, all of those different aspects of trading, I've seen the scorched bones of many traders lying before me. And most of the reason that I see them lying scorched and desolate is the fact that they have a problem with the mental and emotional issues of trading. They have good trading plans, but they can't seem to follow them. So I've made it my life's mission for the last 15 years to help traders with that forgotten area the area that really doesn't get enough attention, and it really is the cause of most trading ills, and that's the mental and emotional issues. So the disciplined trader, that's what the disciplined trader is all about. I can't help but look at markets and talk about markets because, you know, hey, I'm a trader and I always have been. So I do both, but my main thrust is the mental and emotional issues of traders.
Yeah, and having broker-assisted types accounts as well as the managed account, discretionary account, you obviously have met many investors over the years. So your background of knowledge as far as the temperament of people, you know, obviously comes into play. And then basically what you've tried to do is kind of find out where the pitfalls are and try to help people with some of the susceptibilities that can happen when you're trading, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I play a lot of tennis, and I call it the tennis indicator when they start asking me what they should do with their pot stocks now.
Yeah, yeah.
How they're getting killed. And I, even though I'm a proponent of long-term picking the right stocks in that area in the long term, I think you've got to be able to ride out situations like you have right now. So, it really is the forgotten
part of trading. Yeah.
Yeah. Well said.
Hey, Norm.
Yeah.
Have you read the book, The Inner Game of Tennis?
Absolutely. Tim, that is her last name. I know Miss Tim, but Timothy something or other.
Not yeah. Timothy Leary, right?
Tennis fan.
Too. No, that's the inner game of LSD.
All right, let's get on with it here. We've got questions that we go through each and every Monday, and the first one is always going to be, we have the S&P today, and let's just get an opening on that as far as I see on my board. The S&P opened at 31.17, almost 31.18 on the open. Where are we going to be trading between now and Friday on a best guess basis, Neil? What do you see?
I think it's going to go up for a couple days and then down and end up about where we are by Friday.
So Friday, you're looking for it to be essentially flat or a little bit south or north? Because we know nothing stays the same in the world, right?
I'm going to stay up.
Okay, you're going to go with the current momentum and you're going to go with up. Norm, what's your best guess?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and I'll give you the reasons why later, but my suspicion is that by the end of the week, we'll be lower.
Okay. All right. And now we're going to ask confidence level. Neil, the idea that we might be just a bit higher than the 31.18 area by the end of the week, what's your percentage confidence level?
80.
Okay. And Norm, how do you feel on percentage basis that we could be a little bit dipper?
Yeah, I'm going to go more in the 70 level, 60, two-thirds level, 66 and two-thirds.
Okay, not bad. All right, so let's find out what's behind the curtain with all these ideas. Again, we obviously have had a major advance here in the last month or so, going from sub 2,900 to to above 3,100, and that's a pretty darn good rise. So what makes you feel, Neil, that the momentum will continue?
It's just the irrational exuberance. I mean, you know, yeah. I'm in my mid-40s, but I still remember the late 90s. I was in college, Greenspan, every day. Oh, the Fed doesn't watch the market. Duh, of course we do. And then irrational exuberance, Dow's at 6,500, you crazy people, you know? But I can't wait until Greenspan comes out, talks about irrational exuberance. He's going to come out of the closet. He does every couple months or once or twice a year these days and moves the market more than anyone in the world possibly could. But, you know, I still remember back then, and I'm also looking at the S&P 500 PE chart. Type it in on Google.
Yep.
And you're going to see that soon there is a breakout on the PE itself of the S&P at 25. That can go to 35 is my target.
Oh, I got you. So you're saying the valuations are just going to go off the freaking deep end here.
Yeah. Half the rally since 2009 is a valuation rally. That's it.
Right.
But
right.
When the valuations get really high,
yeah.
The crash is going to be huge. And I can't wait till it goes up to 35 or even 40 or more. And I'm going to be sitting there with my finger on the button to buy half my account in puts. And I'm just going to be waiting for the absolute perfect time and ordering Uber Eats and never leaving the house and just waiting.
Yeah. Not unlike fishing, you know, you generally let the marlin run himself tired and let as much you know, string out as possible, and then obviously when he runs out of steam, it's a lot easier to reel him in. So I think with this
just
market, you're letting it run like the sailfish, and then basically at some point when the legs run out, he's a lot easier to reel in. So he obviously stopping making all-time highs would be the first thing that you'd like to see if you want to see a rollover, because it's a new high every week so far.
It'll be a big sell-off to start,
yeah,
and then there'll be a rally to a lower high or almost where it was a high,
yeah,
and that's when you do it. And I'm expecting perhaps if Trump gets reelected, maybe 2 years after that,
yeah,
will be the time to do it.
Well, I think behind Neil Norm's curtain is probably some of it has to do with the concept of the higher something goes in value doesn't make it less risky, right? And that's a mental thing that people have sometimes a hard time understanding. You know, the higher, you know, something goes doesn't mean it's less risky. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but anyway, I got to tell you something that I came up with, like, seriously, 10 years ago was when housing was really booming and housing stocks.
Right.
And I remember looking at the average PE of a housing stock was 4. And then we had this housing boom and the average PE was 8. Mm. Right. So it's just you have something called this, I call it the acceptable PE phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes the norm. But when those things crash, not only does the stock crash, PE crashes. And that's when stocks go down 70%, you know?
Well, I think that PE, shall we say, moderation has already hit Amazon, because when it was above 2000, it was well into the 100 PE ratio, and now it's at 76. So, you know, when they lose their appetite for the PE, even if a company keeps making money like Amazon is doing, it still could have a hard time rising in value if people are just unwilling to play the game at the valuations that it once was at.
Well, look at Apple, the PE is what? I don't even, 17 maybe, something like that?
Yeah, but they're dancing around the idea that because they're getting a lot of service business, that it should be reevaluated. So that's the wrap on rationalizing why the PE ratio should be higher for Apple, because their revenue streams have changed.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or if it's just another who shot John, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. Well, let's swing over to Norm, and Norm will give us a little bit of an idea of some of the reasoning behind his idea that we could be rolling over a little bit by week's end.
Yeah, and I think you know, if you talk about PE ratios, it sounds like Neil wants to short Uber Eats at some point.
No, I said I would be ordering
ordering Uber for Eats me. Oh, I, yeah. Okay.
Can't leave
gotcha.
The house because I'm waiting to pull the trigger. Gotcha.
Wasn't there a guy that like sold out? He moved into an unfurnished apartment about 10 years ago, and he wanted to see whether he could just live in his apartment, eat, and bring everything in and order everything online. Boy, that's really developed. But you know, PE ratios. I mean, a lot of these companies have no reasonable. You know, it's so far in the negative. There is no PE ratio, and yet they zoom because of prospects. So some of these tech stocks, it's. They only mean something. I think it's more established. But in my, I'm looking here at a chart, and I know you can't see it because this is audio only. But if you connect, there's a channel that's been moving higher. The market's been moving. The S&P's been moving higher in this channel since May of this year. What I'm looking at, and if you connect the tops. You have higher highs and higher lows, and if you connect the top made in the very end of very end of April, and you connect that with the top that was made in mid-July, you get the top part of that of the band that this market's been riding. And if you connect on the bottom, if you connect the June low, right around June 1st or 2nd, it looks like, and you connect that, that's the beginning of your next line, and if you connect that with what's going on in the middle of August, that low that was made, you're going to get a nice channel we've been riding. Well, the market right now is at the very, it is touching and actually broke earlier today and came back down within that channel. It touched the top of that, of the channel that it's been riding. And when it did that before, back in the July area, it hit that line a couple of times and then rolled over nicely. And I think that this channel's been, even if you go back further, there's been, it's been following this channel. And I just believe, and if you look at the shorter time frames, there are some formations that I can't really show you that I'm looking at that are pointing to possible lower prices. The other thing is the oversold nature of the overbought nature of the S&P index. So over the 70 level, it's about 74 right now in the RSI. Even though that's really not an indicator that we're ready to cool off, sometimes it just means it's a damn strong market. But I think in the with the history in this channel that it's been riding, and the fact that we are on the high end of the RSI, I think there's a pretty good chance if we get a signal lower, you know, we can see a few percent to maybe more. Who knows? But I think there may be a small correction here.
And the VIX, which is obviously something I've watched for decades, it's rising here today while the market is rising. And sometimes that's an interesting thing. My feeling is if we get above 15 on the VIX, you've got the pretty decent green light that the rollover is in play.
Yeah.
But that's just my little opinion. You know what I mean?
No, well, I know you're a VIX guy, but in fact, I just read a report on the VIX. You may have even written it, but it was just recently just showing how low the VIX is right now.
Yeah.
And that. At other points, this was the timing for correction, corrective action. So,
it's in a bullish zone, so that's why it's not a negative for the market at 1264 or 13 or 11, or it's not negative for the market, but it's telling you that if we are going to commence a drop, then you want to see this VIX start accelerating a bit to the upside, because that would be a little tell that the momentum or the volatility is switching. But right now, like I say, it is still in an area of bullishness.
No question.
Yeah. So you can't fight City Hall on that one. All right. Now, with regards to some of the stuff that you guys are doing, and give us a little idea of your methodology, Neil, as far as, you know, your technical indicators that you like, I know there's a variety of them, including, you know, the Japanese candles and all that kind of stuff. Do you have, you know, a little bit of an overview on some of the things that you look at to try to make a decision on things?
Is the audio working because it was off?
Yeah, sure.
Well, just something that's ringing a bell right now for me.
Yeah,
since it's a Monday and it's November, is that do yourself a favor and order yourself a copy of the Stock Trader's Almanac, written by Jeffrey Hirsch, and his dad did it before him. program since the 70s. It literally talks about every month, every day, every week, presidential cycles, every cycle you can imagine. If you just want to sit back, read some really interesting stuff and sort of use it as getting a bit more confidence. If everything is working, looking like it's going where you want it to go, and then you read something in that book and it's also in your favor, it's going to help you make a decision. So the best day in the market is Monday, right? So basically, if you bought futures at the close on Friday and sold them at the open Monday or later in the day on Monday, that's basically all you'd ever have to do. Not a lot of people are going to do that, but it's true. And the best 6-month strategy starts in November through April. So if all you did is sell stocks November through April, or held stocks November through April and sell them the rest of the year, you're basically way ahead of the game, like statistically. So that's one of the things I think of sometimes. And it's November. Why would stocks go higher? I mean, if this was late September, I think maybe it's a bit sketchy, but I use point and figure. That's what I learned when I was a broker, right, towards the end of my career. And there's a concept in there called bullish percent. If anyone wants to write it down, that's kept us out of every single crash for 15 years. And you can also use it for sectors. And then I also use the Ichimoku cloud, which I picked up a few years ago, to sort of fine tune the entry points with point and figure, because that's just X's and O's. So you don't get any hammer candles and things like that with point and figure. But if I had to choose between the two, I would choose point and figure nonetheless. But those are the concepts that I use. And basically it goes like this: which way is the market going? And then which way are the sectors going? And then what stock do I pick within the sectors? And a lot of times we'll just do the triple leveraged ETFs.
Now, I'm no expert on point and figure, and I'm sure many people listening aren't as well. I had it explained to me a little bit at a financial consultant's office once over at Wells Fargo.
I got a course on point and figure.
Oh, okay, good.
But I can send it to you, Jim. And if anyone wants to subscribe to my newsletter, I'll send out a link for that course.
Yeah, because there's really like X's and then O's and then, you know.
Well, if something goes up, you stack the X's in a vertical column. So if you want to know how long do I hold this stock, well, you just look at it every day. And as long as you're in X's, you're okay.
Gotcha. And when it turns into O's, that's a turning sign.
Yeah, it's usually about a 6% move changes columns into O's.
Okay.
And then if it moves up again, you'll have a breakout and you'll really see these fantastic patterns coming in over and over again, and you know, higher highs and higher lows. And you can draw these beautiful trend lines on point of figure. And there's nothing like it. It started by Charles Dow in the 1800s, just on graph paper.
I was going to say, this thing and goes back to the beginning of time. This type of, shall we say, technical analysis is very, very time-tested, right?
Yeah. And you know what's amazing is one of the things it's really good for, and it's not even on the system that I use, is if you go to stockcharts.com, and it's really great for something like a small tech, BIOS tech stock under 10, and you can change the box size to a percent, 1 or 2%. And what you'll do is you'll find the perfect box size where you can just time these things unbelievably. So if you have some sort of penny gold stock and you don't know when to buy or sell it, use the point of figure charts. It's best.
Is it a little bit more cut and dried than, say, the Elliott wave, where obviously if you're counting different waves, you'd be totally coming up with different information?
Well, the thing about point of figures, there's a traditional box size, which is what stock charts will set you up with.
Right.
If you want to speed it up, you can change it to half that percent, half a percent. And so what I'll do is I'll look at different time frames. Mm-hmm. And so I'll say, oh, that's the breakout or the real breakout, you know, or I'll see something and I go, oh, this is a little breakdown. All it has to do is move up maybe half a percent for me to get in. And
so you can change the sensitivity to it, not unlike you could do it with a moving average, you know, obviously 3-day or 10-day or 50-day, you know what I mean?
It's sort of like if you do candles on a daily or a weekly chart. I mean, I just remember Facebook, for example. If you had Facebook on the weekly chart, you would have held that for at least 3 years for a huge gain. And if you go to point and figure and you change it to, let's say, each box size is 2% or 3%, and let's say you think you have a big winner and you don't want to miss out, because so many people, there'll be a stock, they'll say, man, I sold it, I was up 50%, it went up 500%. You know, those are the biggest regrets you ever have in trading.
Right.
And you just set the box size to be a bit bigger and you just say, I'm holding this thing until it breaks that trend. And it might not break that trend for 5 years.
You
just sit there biting your nails, and it could be the one trade that gets you that log cabin, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hey, Norm, what are some of the things that you're looking at as far as your technical indicators? And of course, what things are you looking at from a trader point of view that you're finding out that people, you know, repeat this mistake quite a bit? And you know, what are some of the pitfalls that you've seen most commonplace when you're doing your discipline trader, conferencing?
Well, I think, let me get, Neil, the Trader's Almanac, does that still come in two, they're so big, about 10 years ago, they split it into two volumes. Is that still the case?
No, it's just a really, last time I ordered, it was a fairly small book with one of those, like, sort of like those rings that it binds with.
Right,
like,
right.
Yeah, yeah, it's awesome. Everyone should order it. I mean, there's not a single trading floor anywhere in the world that doesn't have Stock Traders Almanac.
And you got it's unbelievable. It has the seasonals, has everything in it.
You'll be filled with all sorts of knowledge you can tell other people that they'll never be able to use because they don't trade, but you will know it.
And you got to be the youngest guy in the world using point and figure, but it's tremendous. We used to use it when we used to have to buy the chart. And with a pencil and ruler and draw the lines on the paper years ago.
Yes.
Everyone on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange uses point and figure. Mm. And I know that because I've spoken to some. It's amazing how many of these Chicago guys are doing newsletters. I meet them everywhere I go. They're all from Chicago. But when I see the bullish percent turn into O's, the next day there's a sell-off almost every single time.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love that. I used to love the point and figure. Yeah. In any event, I think I'm going to look back into it. You kind of got me interested again in that. I think that in answer to your question, Jim, you know, I think the training, you've got to build, whatever you're doing, you have to build confidence. Somebody who looks at a chart without any sense behind it or affirmative thoughts behind it can get shaken out of a market. Let me tell you what I mean. Like right now, I kind of take a look at the market. I do take a look at the market in a general way. And when I say market, I may be looking at grains. I may be looking at currencies. I may be looking at, because I'm a futures trader mostly, I may be looking at, But I start with the macro look. And right now, I've got my eyes on the dollar index and the currencies in general. You know, you've seen the recent rally in the British pound. You've seen some weakness in the yen, some strength, a little bit of strength in the euro dollar. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but it's some of these currencies seem to be in the bottoming phase. And to me, looks like the dollar index is in the topping phase, is in a topping phase for the moment. I'm talking for the next few months. And I, you know, when I see this, I say to myself, okay, if it comes together and both sides confirm, then I'm going to look to trade on the long side of the currencies. And with respect to that, which currency? So then I narrow it down a little bit more. In fact, I'm having for clients and past clients, I'm having a talk today at 3 o'clock about one of the markets that I'm looking at, which happens to be the yen. And the yen tends to move in opposition to the stock market. So it kind of plays into my feeling about a possible correction in the next couple of weeks. And therefore I'm looking at places. I'm setting up a situation to buy the Japanese yen and layer into that upon certain technical moments in time where the market reaches a point, crosses certain lines that I've drawn on my chart, resistance areas that it seems that it will overcome in my view. But the idea is that I think you've got to have a plan, something that you perceive may be happening, and then use your technical analysis to execute that plan if it happens. And that's going to take patience. It's going to take a plan. It's going to take patience to run the plan. It can't be, and you got to watch that you're not reading into the plan your idea just to be right. So it's, it does involve a lot of emotion, but if you have a perception of the market and you allow the technicals to affirm your thinking, then you're going to wind up with a very confident way, be a confident trader and be able to make runs all the way up. This Japanese yen move that I'm anticipating is the kind of move that I've built big positions on in the past and had some of my big wins. So I'm kind of excited about looking and teaching how to do that.
Can I mention something about currencies?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, so I'm a big pro-Brexit guy because I think that England is the greatest empire the world's ever seen. And if it wasn't for England, there'd be no America, there'd be no Australia, there'd be no New Zealand, you know, there'd be no Canada. So I can't stand seeing a country like that shackled by the EU, you know, but they have this fighting spirit you've never seen before, you know, just what they do. But I missed out a few years ago trading currencies when I saw the Brexit results coming in from London. And this was pretty late at night, Pacific time. And it looked like, oh, Brexit's going to fail. I thought, oh, no, that sucks. And then the next day, I saw, what the heck's going on here? And the pound was down and Brexit referendum was going to pass. And what I didn't realize at the time was that the rural votes had not come in as fast as the London votes. right? Because we know London are a bunch of, you know, these, a lot of left wingers in London. And so I'm looking at the Ichimoku cloud on the pound. And if you would have traded the 15-minute time frame, write this down, you could have so incredibly easily timed that trade so perfectly, you would have doubled your trading account at least, stayed up all night and had breakfast and think, yeah, I just made 100% in about 12 hours. Now, what's coming up is a new election, Conservatives and Jeremy Corbyn, Conservatives, Boris Johnson's pro-Brexit. And from what I recall, Corbyn is, you know, left-wing, extreme liberal, anti-Brexit. And so stay up all night, look at the pound and watch the results come in the British election. And you will see the pound either go up or the pound going down. If Conservatives are winning, the pound's going to go up. If Liberals are winning, the pound is going to go down. But wait till the rural votes come in. Don't trade right away. Use the 15-minute Ichimoku time frame and you could have, I mean, you can double your account or more depending on the leverage you use. But don't sue me if you lose all your money.
No, it's a very interesting chart.
By the way, I have no idea what I'm talking about and did not listen to my advice. There's the disclaimer in case you try to use it.
Yeah. I mean, your best guess on things. But the thing is if you look at the British pound, only once since 1970-something has it ever been lower than the 119 that it hit. And it obviously had a lot of back and forth around that 119 level. So if that's going to be a double low and they get the kind of news that makes people bullish on the British pound, you know, this is a stuff that used to be above 2 and then almost at 250. And this is a currency that has been whacked very, very hard.
Yeah.
You're not messing around with it by the all-time high by any means. Huh?
All-time high of what?
No, I'm saying you're not sniffing around something that's near an all-time high by any means.
No, plenty of room to go to the upside if Boris Johnson wins and for Bojo and you know you got almost 10% downside if the other guy wins. So I mean you can have an awesome trade, but wait, don't trade it right away because that will be London and London will be voting. You know, it's, you can't get a good call. You have to wait till all the votes come in and only if it's conservative majority would I go long the pound. They project conservative majority. Anything else I wouldn't trade it, or if it's liberal majority, I'd short pound when it becomes obvious.
Norm,
however,
do you ever,
however your politics lean, that's the call. So
Hey Norm, do you ever do much with the cross trading? Because Bloomberg had a guy on there and he was talking about that if the replacement to NAFTA goes through, that the Mex peso could have a good advance against the euro or something like that.
No, I don't do crosses because they're not futures contracts. But
I got you.
Sometimes I will do spreads, which is pretty much the same thing, only you're dealing with a couple of contracts. But I will say that one thing that I believe is about to happen is another stall in the China in with this Chinese deal, that there will be no deal, and that, you know, whenever they say they're getting close, it doesn't happen. I want to give people
euphemism.
Something like that. I'm looking here.
Norm, where can you trade the exotics like the Mexican peso and the Turkish lira? Is that what it's called? I forget.
Well, so, you know,
probably interbank. Interbank, maybe something like that.
Yeah, you can. Some of them are on some. I think there may be one of those contracts on ICE, but I'll have to. You know, I just trade the majors, but don't know off the top of my head. And it changes. There's a woman that I follow. I'm trying to find her on Twitter. Here she is. I want to give this to everybody who's listening.
Yeah, are you going out now?
Yeah, I'm going to
go. Hang on one second. She's a Chinese. She's a, gosh, I just can't believe I can't find it here, but I'll get it before it's over. We're over here. But she's, what she does is she's a journalist for a Chinese-American TV station in China. She's Chinese, and she gives the Chinese perspective on what's going on. You know, she points out all the things that are going on in the United States that show that democracy is maybe not working, and then communism isn't so bad. But she does it in a way that I know most major traders watch this woman, and I'm going to have the name for you before we're done here today.
Did you want to get a little bit into the yen situation?
I can. Let me mention what's going on with the yen as the way I see it here. We are, if you look at the daily chart of the yen, we're testing lows that we made earlier in the year. We're right at that area. The 91, right in that 90, 91 area. We did reach 91.5 in early last week in the, or Friday of the week before in the yen. And we've kind of come up to the 9,200 area, a little over that 92.1 today, 92.2. And so we're testing that bottom, but if it's hard to, it's just hard to show you without being able to show you the visual, but there's a head and shoulders type of a formation that I'm anticipating will continue. It's actually already formed and already broken. If you look at the 4-hour chart, if you pull up a 4-hour chart on the Japanese yen, you'll see a relatively, a very clear, really, head and shoulders bottom at the low, below 90, about the 91 point where the head reaches the low. And we've extended from there, we've corrected without making a low, and now we see, we're started to move higher. And so there are levels as it crosses recent highs that are resistances that once broken, one can add positions. So, and it's happening all at an RSI level that is telltale of a bullish market developing. So all of those things said, I'm looking at, but I need, I can't really get into the detail on how I add positions. And in a process like this, I go very light in the beginning because you've got minor confirmation, but a lot of anticipation, which is not an ideal situation. But as we cross some of those resistance areas that become support, if you go back and check those supports and then make new highs on that recent move, then those are places you can add positions as we move to new resistances above. So I'm really excited about it because I do see a number of things that are relatively clear to me from experience.
Right.
That we could, and the great part about it is that if you're wrong and you start out in light, you're not going to get hurt by it.
Yeah.
And as you move up, what I like to do, as you add positions, I like to keep my stop at that, at a break-even level, so that if I'm wrong, if it all comes tumbling down, which these kinds of approaches can, that I haven't lost anything. I've lost time, which actually is a very big factor. You don't want to lose a lot of, you only have so many trading days in a year.
But yeah.
These are some of the big moves that can develop in the yen. So I urge people to take a look at the yen, look at the US dollar too, and see if you don't think it may be in a vulnerable position. That because if one breaks, it's not the only thing that affects the yen. There are a number of things that affect the yen, but the dollar certainly is one of them. And any southerly move in the Dow or the S&P is going to affect the yen positively, or at least has been all year this year.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a longer term graph. The lows that occurred in 2015 were not taken out in 2016. Mm-hmm. Were not taken out in 2017. They weren't taken out in 2018. And now this year, they're not being taken out so far either. So I guess that's some of the reasons you think that there could be a little bit of a volcanic activity underneath, and it could resolve itself with a pretty decent move on the upside if it had a match lit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that once, if you're a person like me, if you've traded a long time, you almost can't have a chart without drawing in your support and resistance areas. And I think that gives you the roadmap of where to watch for the next move to have a little resistance. And when it breaks, usually checks back to that resistance.
Yeah.
That's more of an Elliott wave type of a thing where it can come back and check. And those are great places to add when you make new highs on the run. So you're really formalizing your education.
Yeah. Neil, you're with us, right?
I wanted to mention something about currencies and I like all the analysis Norm has done. There's just one thing I remember once again from the 90s is that the more U.S. troops that come home from overseas, the stronger the U.S. dollar gets. And I'm by no means any type of geopolitical expert at all. And I don't know really much about the troops in the Middle East and how to get them out safely for everyone. Because remember what happened to England when the Romans left, everything went crazy and you had a king in every valley. That's how it eventually became the United Kingdom. So, leaving in a day is probably a really bad idea. But I do know that when troops come home, it's good for the dollar. So if there is a momentum or talk in that direction, it will give some type of underlying strength to the dollar. So if the dollar sells off, it may not be a continuing negative trend. This is something to think about if you're trading the dollar. Whatever.
Yeah, it's another factor to throw into the
into
the soup. Neil, any markets that you're kind of focused on? You think that there could be something special happening, either in stock or the futures?
Yeah, I like banks right now. We're long banks. You could use any leverage ETF. JP Morgan looks like it's just about to make a nice move. You could get a nice move on a call option on JP Morgan. That's my pick.
Yeah, is that it's always considered best in class, right?
Well, I just know that if it's a big market cap company that's a leader in the sector, I know that there's going to be a lot of options volume and the spread is going to be low. So I just go for something like that.
Also, all these index funds that are all over the place, this is one of the top holdings. So obviously, if the market itself is going to be fairly firm, it almost forces people to buy certain stocks, you know, because like Apple, like Microsoft, like JP Morgan, because they're all in the top 10 of these, most of these holdings, you know what I mean?
Right. So if they're buying the ETF, they have to buy the stock.
To buy the stock. Any of the smaller banks like BBT, which is a Florida type of bank that is also been climbing the wall here, paying 3.28 billion?
No clue, but that sounds good.
Yeah. But if you look at BBT, I know that when I was in Naples, they had a lot of branches down there and that kind of stuff. I think they might be up in Fort Lauderdale. Are they, Norm?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. And they've been a pretty solid mover, too. Not quite as extended as the JP Morgan. In addition to banks, anything else on your radar?
Well, that's my big pick for the week. I'm just looking at BBT right now. Hold on. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of these triple leverage ETFs lately. Just to be honest, if you want to find the best pick in a sector, you got to be three times as correct as that triple leverage ETF, you know? So, I mean, most of a move in a stock's going to come from the sector. I mean, we were long semis a few weeks ago. We took profits too early. But then again, if I had just bought AMD, I would have outperformed that ETF. So, you know, there's definitely...
And the semis are up here making another, or pressing their 52-week high here today again, huh?
I love semis. You can't have a real bull market without semis. I mean, all these big companies have to upgrade their equipment because they send their consultants out with a laptop that's even 1 year old. They look like a joke.
What's that triple double leverage symbol?
SPXL. I would also buy that. That's the market. It's SOXL, Soxel. And let me just take a quick look here. I'm going to bring it up. Soxel, yeah.
It's having another good day today, up about 1% for the day, and go up and press their highs a little bit too, huh?
Soxel, I would do the breakout at 238. That's just 1.5% above where it is now, and it's triple leverage. But I mean, you could also just do triple leverage S&P. Sometimes I don't even have a favorite sector. Sometimes I just give up and I just say we just got to do the market.
Is there a financial triple leverage too?
Yeah, FAS, and we are long that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my disclaimer. Like CNBC, that is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like I say, I mean, everybody should always do their own investigation on all this stuff. And obviously, triple leverage is not for everybody. So, you know, you have to understand what you're buying and understand what you're selling. No doubt about that.
It's for me, though, Jim.
Yeah, yeah.
I know.
No, you know what I mean? It's a situation where, you know, just because something's mentioned anywhere, you know, you really got to do your own thing and see what's right for you. With regards to Norm, we were talking currency, but there's 26 commodities. So any of the other that look worthwhile? Or
yeah, I'm going to give a plug to our friend Jake, who got me watching the sauce. But before I do, let me give you the name of this. I think it's a she, but I think it may be a he. It's hard to tell by the picture because the head, all I can see is the top of the person's head, and it's short hair. So, and it's she or he is the editor-in-chief of Chinese and English editions of the Global Times. So the person's name is capital H-U. So the first name H-U. Last name XIJIN. XIJIN. And if you can follow him or her on Twitter, and gives a very different perspective on what's going on and how possibly the other side sees what happens here and what's going on there. So ever since I've been in, I've been to China last year, I find this person's analysis is very valuable in sometimes not going too big on something and sometimes going bigger than I normally would on something based on the perspective. But as far as your, with respect to your question, there are two markets that, two soft, what they call the softs. The softs in commodities are orange juice, sugar, coffee, cotton.
Pork bellies.
There are two markets that Jake was mentioning that I've been following that are both in the sugar market right now is in a critical position. It's made a rally off its yearly low. It's moved from 10.5 cents to 11 and to the right under the 12 cent level, and it's pulled back. A close over 12 looks to me like an easy ride to 12.5. That's where the 200-day moving average is, and then to 13, which is the most recent high back in June. So that's a nice play. And the thing about this is it happens quickly in sugar. Sugar is a market that tends to move. Now, normally I would say that when we used to watch sugar when gold moved, soybeans, sugar, and gold used to all kind of move together. But you really can't say that. that anymore, but you got to look at every market on its own. And so sugar has some potential here. The other market is the coffee market, which is, I mention it because it's actually doing that backfill that I mentioned before when I talked about the Japanese yen. The coffee market has moved from its yearly low at about 93 cents a pound all the way to $1.10. It's come back now to the $1.05 area as it's pulled back. So and it's hitting a recent high that was made back in September. So we've made a new high in this run. We've pulled back an amount. I haven't done my Fibonacci work, but it's probably at the first Fibonacci line, and it's right near that resistance, which is now a support. If we hold that and start moving higher, we could see a move to 118 pretty quickly. So the coffee market is another market, coffee and sugar that are following the guidelines really that Jake set for us from a seasonal standpoint.
I got you. Yeah, and the low area of sugar was around what, 11 or so?
I think it reached more like 10.5. Let me take a quick look. The low that I see is 1068. So right in that area. 1068 was the absolute low tick back in the middle of September. Looks like about the September 10th. And we've been really moving up ever since. Had a nice run and then a back gap up and then filling the gap and came back up, came up another 1.5% and really is at highs right now in this run. So, we should see some resistance right in this area as we're approaching a recent high made back in August, the first day of August and the last day of July, first day of August in that area was a high made. And it looks like that's at about 1220 level, but getting past there, going to see a quick 30 points and then to the 200-day moving average and then boom, passes there, it's a clear shot to 13. And then, 14 and 15, sugar can move. It can go to 20 cents.
Yeah, I'm kind of seeing this 10 area was kind of a double low area, not unlike that yen double low. And is there any correlation between sugar and the yen at all? Because it does have some kind of a feeling that if it broke above some resistance above, it could get going pretty good, huh?
I don't know. Let me grab some of this sweet green tea and I'll let you know.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff because, these commodities really haven't been able to get out of their own way for such a long time.
Yeah,
and so, every dog has its day, and some people are thinking that the commodities may have a future. I've seen some large companies come out with a commodity fund in the last year that's supposed to mirror the Bloomberg Index. And some of these companies are extremely large, and for them to come out with a product, I don't think they've done no research on the sector. And so I think it's kind of interesting to see some of the bigger companies coming out with a product on something while the prices are still languishing down here. Maybe they are also, their research is maybe doing some anticipating that the winds of change in the commodity sector might be changing in the months and years to come too, huh?
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. I think, as you said, I think people have to do their own study and own work. I'm just saying,
of course,
if you can find somebody that you trust or think has done their work and their conclusion is that, say, sugar is going higher, if you do your work independently and come to the same conclusion, that's going to, that's the kind of thing for me that affects what I do and what I don't do. But it's got to be based on my work. Now, if too many people are thinking the same thing.
That's not a good thing.
Yeah.
But, what's interesting is for, say a larger portfolio who wanted to have money in energy, money in healthcare, money in banks, money in utilities, whatever, I'm sure one sector that's not represented in many people's portfolio at all is the commodity sector. And therein may be a situation of value where you rotate X amount of dollars out of something that's extended, be a tech or semis or whatever, and maybe rotate some money into an underappreciated situation with maybe a longer term time horizon.
Yeah, what do they call that, Neil? When something's unrelated to something else?
Non-correlated?
There you go. Anything over you 3
also got correlated.
Yeah. So, that sometimes that's because, the healthcare sector got way out of whack because, everybody thought we're going to, eliminate our healthcare system. And companies that spit out tremendous amount of capital, like United Healthcare, got discounted significantly. And, people are forgetting that somebody who's talking on a stage and before they're elected may have a hard time passing some of this legislation. And so, getting everything out of Dodge City before any legislation's passed sometimes can be crazy.
Right.
finds to me also, like, it's about the certainty also, even if it's, you know, something like you're waiting for something big to happen that hasn't happened yet. Mm. And once it actually happens, then you'll get the move that you wanted, you know? So, I mean, what's in commodities that we're waiting for, you know, farm bailouts, I mean, the China stuff, maybe something like that.
Yeah. And all the stuff in the commodity sector is being used and consumed by people. So it's not like just a theoretical software or, you know, a theoretical business plan. You know, at least this stuff, you know, does have a definite use because people are consuming it. And obviously over history, you know, they've had volatility because of shortages and surpluses, you know what I mean? So expecting some kind of volatility in a longer term basis is not a crazy idea.
I mean, the lower the dollar gets, commodities should go up. But, I mean, we'll see.
Well, I mean, my thing that I keep coming back to is the administration wants a weak dollar, so it'll help trade, and the Fed wants inflation to go up so that this debt can be it can be maintained. I mean, obviously, the reason they're afraid of deflation is just imagine deflation with all this debt out there. Then any covenant wouldn't cover the debt, and then you'd have the not a dissimilar situation that you had with the housing, where the covenants on the loans of mortgages went away, and obviously we saw what the value of those things were worth. So, you know, with all the sovereign debt and all the negative yielding debt and all the government debt and the municipal debt and corporate debt, you know, deflation is a very scary venture for the people who understand how much debt's out there, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think house prices might be going down because millennials can't afford a house.
Well, that's one thing that helped some of the companies is they had entry-level homes. And there's a statistic, almost 70% of people in their 20s still live at home.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big group if you can get them out of the basement to buy a starter home. So that's why some of the companies that have starter homes like Lennar and Pulte and all those kind of guys, you know, they got bid up a little bit because there has been a little bit of migration out of the basement into their own home.
You know, I read something real interesting about the history of Germany, and there's so many things that happen in Germany that you can relate to the economy, you know, like Weimar Republic, these types of things.
Yeah.
Hyperinflation. I mean, one of them is with the Weimar Republic and hyperinflation, if you were in the market, you would not have lost your money. You would not have lost your wealth because market went up.
Right.
But another thing that's really interesting is that after World War II, housing was really expensive in Germany, and a lot of these conservative parties couldn't figure out why they were losing votes to socialism, you know, because they wanted to stop socialism, right? And so they figured out what it really came down to is simply just the price of housing. And so they did whatever they could, and I don't know what they did, maybe tried to get more houses built or whatever, but when house prices are low, people do not care about socialism. Because, I mean, imagine now if everyone's making what they're making and their mortgage payment was $900. Would there really be this new millennial move to socialism? No, because you'd have, or if you didn't have your healthcare costs double, so you'd have $900 for your mortgage, a couple $100 for health insurance, and a few $1,000 left over. You'd be like, hey, capitalism is awesome, right?
Right.
But now you have houses $1,000,000. None of these millennials can afford anything. You know, their insurance is going to cost $300-$400 a month for health insurance. And they say, screw this, socialism rocks.
Yeah.
You know, and it's
yeah.
all housing. And what the government doesn't realize that they're doing is they're going to have tens of millions of these guys that are just about to vote or are voting now. And they don't understand that it's housing. And all you got to do is study history and realize, you know, you just can't inflate the money supply. Because I just wrote a report yesterday that showed, if you go to tradingview.com, not Trader Review, but Trading ING View, type in M2, you'll see the money supply has tripled over the last 15 years.
Yeah.
That's basically what inflation is. And then you look at house prices, exactly correlated.
Yeah. And what about the debt? I mean, the national debt, I mean, that's got to be scaring the hell out of you.
Yeah. But that money is debt. Yeah. You can't lay down the national debt because the debt itself is money.
Right? All right, guys, we're coming to the top of the hour, and I want to make sure you guys can reintroduce yourself and make sure people know how to get a hold of you. And if you have any special offers, of course, this is a great time to offer them. So let's start out with Neil and just a quick review of what yourself and TraderReview.net is and any special offers and how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jim.
Sure.
Yeah, so I used to be a broker. I now do this, and I send out the best picks that I possibly can from a top-down macroeconomic approach. And you can go to TraderReview.com or .net for my newsletter, get a lot of free reports. Follow me, and if you like my work, maybe you might want to sign up for my picks.
And you also have some teaching going on as well over there, don't you?
Yeah. When you sign up as a member, you get sort of the crash course course in Point and Figure in the Cloud, about an hour each. And then I also have a big Point and Figure course that I sell, which is 10 hours. And I charge for that one. And if you sign up, you'll get an email eventually in a week or two for that.
Great. Great to have you here, Neil. And Norm, a quick situation here on the Disciplined Trader. And I know you have a couple of special things that you've got for certain people who want to, shall we say, reinvigorate their ability to trade. Can you go over that again?
Well, I just want to it really starts by getting in contact with me. And one great way to do that is to pick up a book that I wrote called Mental Fitness for Traders, which is over 250,000 downloads over the last 10 years. And if you don't have that book, it's kind of a lighthearted but serious view of the things that we go through as traders. So if you go to thedisciplinedtrader.com, thedisciplinedtrader.com/MF and the number 4 and the letter T, Mental Fitness number 4, Mental Fitness for Traders, okay? MF, the number 4 and the letter T. So the Disciplined Trader, MF4T. And pick up, just download yourself a copy. That'll put you in rhythm with me for some of the other things that we're doing, including our two-on-one coaching that we started just this last week, and really are having a lot of fun with that, really getting traders disciplined in a little bit different way than we usually do. So in any event, MF4T after the disciplinedtrader.com and pick up the book.
Okay, perfect. Hey, thanks for being here again, Norm. Always great. And Neil as well. I'm going to turn it back over to David. I have a weekly market update letter that I do provide. So if you'd like to pick up that, just go to optionprofessor@gmail.com and we'll hook you up with that each and every week. Back to David right now. Thanks a lot, guys. And thanks everybody for listening.
All right. Thanks, guys. Just a quick reminder to subscribe to Timing Research on YouTube and your favorite podcast network. Or you can go to timingresearch.com to get access to the report for this week, or the recording of this show as soon as it's available, or any of the past shows and events. We had a big event over the weekend. 5 different traders gave talks, so that was the 6th Synergy Trader event. So if you haven't had a chance to take a look at that yet, just go to timingresearch.com and you can get instant access to all those. Damon Pavlatos, Anka Medcalf, Matt Buckley, Jake Bernstein, and Mark Sachs gave talks. So like I said, that's on Timing Research as well, videos and audio only. And then also be sure to join us tomorrow for the 103rd episode of Analyze Your Trade. Felix Frey will be back, and Jim will be moderating again. So you can get access to that by going to timingresearch.com/live and join us at 4 p.m. Eastern time. And then I just want to thank my guests again for today. So Neil Batho of TraderReview.net, Norman Hallett of the DisciplinedTrader.com, and Jim Kenny of OptionProfessor.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, David. Thanks.